Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald and Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the DC metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, yes, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking with Ed Bortnick, a CPA and shareholder in the firm of SKMB. And Ed is one of the few accountants that I know that can actually make numbers seem interesting. And we're going to talk a little bit today about business valuations, the hows, the whens, the whys, and what to look for, what to avoid, and all that sort of good stuff. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Well, great to be here.
Excellent.
Be here. I want to point out to you, you know, that I'm not just a CPA. I'm also what's called a certified valuation analyst, which makes me an expert in valuing businesses. I'm also a master analyst in financial forensics.
Awesome. Well, that's a lot of stuff for me to remember, so I'm glad that you pointed it out. And since we are talking about business valuations, I was remiss in not mentioning that. And what I'd like to do, Ed, is start a little bit with real life circumstances. And I know we want to talk about when and where business valuations can be used, maybe in more conflicted type arenas. But talk to me a little bit first. If I'm somebody and I'm interested in buying a business, let's say I want to buy a hair salon. All right. Why is it important for me, or what would I look to get a good sense of what that business is worth? Why would I want to do that?
Well, you want to make sure that you're paying the right price for the business. But what I would suggest in that kind of situation, when you're looking to actually buy a business, I would get, depending on the size. Now, a hair salon's pretty simple operation. So in that kind of case, I would go right to a business broker because they'd be doing these deals. However, if you have a large corporation that you're getting ready to sell, I would go to an M&A firm, because what they're going to do is they're going to take a look at your business. They're going to see what needs to be changed, what needs to be fixed. They'll help you fix those problems. And then what they'll do is put together a prospectus, and they'll put it out to maybe four or five different prospective buyers, and they'll start what's called a controlled auction. And you have to, instead of getting just what's a fair market value, you may get a strategic value. So that's really, in that kind of situation, I wouldn't just go to a business valuator. I'd actually go to an M&A firm.
So go to someone who's used to buying and selling those types of business, who can direct you? Is that right.
That's not a necessary situation I like to get involved in, because you really need somebody who buys and sells business, who actually sells.
Okay. So let's talk about then situations that you look at where business valuations are more prevalent or more necessary. Let's talk about those areas first.
One area is in the area of gift tax returns. If you're actually gifting an interest in a business, it could be an employee, it could be an outsider, it could be your children. You need a business valuation in order to establish a value for your gift tax return. If you look at the instructions for the gift tax return on page 6, item 11, it talks about evaluations in accordance with section 2003(1) of the Internal Revenue Code. So that's a situation where you're going to need a valuation. For sure.
So, let me stop you for a second, because again, a lot of folks who listen to this, right, are not nearly as sophisticated. So give me a specific situation and how you would deal with someone, you know, I don't want to say dumb it down, but simplify it for the average person like me. I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about.
Let's say you own an automobile dealership.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make 3 gifts of 10% each to your children. So what I would do, come in and take a look and say, look, I have to learn your business. I'm going to meet with you. I'm going to go over your business, go over the history from its inception. Then I'm going to take the last 5 years' financials, analyze them. Several different methods I may use to value the company. I may capitalize your earnings for the last 5 years, weighting the most current years heavier. I may ask you to do a projection, especially in these times with COVID, because the last couple of years have not been normal years. And I might take a look at your cash flow and discount that based on, let's say, for instance, normalize your cash flow at $1 million. I may say a capitalization rate is 10%. Dividing the million by 10% comes up with $10 million with a $10 million valuation. I'm going to say, okay, wait a minute. You're gifting a minority interest to your children. They don't have any real power. They can't hire and sell. They can't hire people. They can't necessarily sell their interest. So I'm going to say you can't. It's not like if they want to sell their interest, it's not going to be like selling a stock on exchange. They can't get their money in 3 days. They may not even be able to sell it at all. If they try to sell it, they're going to have to employ attorneys, other professionals. It's going to take time. So we're going to do a valuation discount. It may be 20%, it may be 35%, it may be higher based on the situation.
So when you talk about the valuation discount, you're saying that you can't just look at that $10 million number because that's not the same, right, as just being able to go trade the stock on the exchange and know that you're going to get the $10 million for it.
Exactly.
Okay. Put me in that business owner's position. So I want to gift my business or a portion of it to my kids so that they avoid paying taxes when I die. And so now you've come in and you've given me this value, right, based upon with these discount factors and so forth. So now what do I do with that? How do I do that?
Let's talk about Steve Jobs for a minute.
Okay.
Let's say when he first started his business, it really wasn't worth much at all, but he had a vision. He said, this business is going to be worth I'm the only shareholder. This business is going to be worth a heck of a lot of money down the road. So what I'm going to do is now I'm going to get this business valued. I want to give 10% to my children. So I'll hire a business valuation expert like myself. We'll go in and value the stock now. Let's say it's worth $10,000 now. I'll take $1,000 forget about discounts for a minute. So let's say it's worth $1,000. What happened? So I've got this out of my estate. Let's say I'm given 40%. Mm-hmm. I've got all this money out of my estate. Now I die 10 years later. The company's worth $6 billion. Look what I've saved.
Right.
So that's a reason. So if you've got a business that you think is going to take mm-hmm. off and you think you want to leave fortunes to your kids or other people, now's a good time to do it.
Interesting. Did Steve Jobs do that, by the way?
I imagine he probably did. I don't know. He was a pretty smart guy.
Apparently. Yeah. That's one person we've all heard of course. Tell me a little bit about how you work. Let's say there's a dispute between shareholders and whether it's in litigation or not in litigation, stockholder dispute, whatever it may be, as you know, one group wants to buy the other group out, one group wants to sell, whatever the case may be. Give us a scenario of what might occur and why a business valuation would be important in that type of situation.
Well, it's important because the judge needs some benchmark when he makes his decision on what to award to the litigants. What I would do is I would meet with the owner of the business. I would go over his history since his inception. I would go over it. I would ask him about his competitors, where the problems are in his business. Then I would analyze his business. Like I say, I would take 5 years probably of his business operations, analyze that, and come up with the valuation.
Okay. We're in litigation. You know, there's two sets of shareholders, whatever it might be. You've done this valuation. Where are the hot button areas in a stockholder dispute when you're looking at maybe differences of opinion over what a valuation might be?
Oh, there's definitely differences of opinions between the valuators, and the judge has to make, trier of fact has to make the decision. What I normally do, I will take two copies of my report to litigation when I'm on the stand, and I'll actually give a copy to the judge and take him through the valuation because I want the judge to understand what I've done. And I found that some judges are very educated when it comes to evaluations. I find that the federal court, the district courts seem to be a little more up to speed than the circuit courts. I don't know if you found that or not.
Okay. Well, I think for me, I think it depends on the judge, regardless of what courthouse I'm in. Okay. So when you say that there's going to be disagreements between the valuators, what are the two or three most likely places that a judge or someone's going to see those disagreements?
Sometimes in the discount rate, maybe in the methods. Whether somebody's the judge may one valuator may have used what's called the market approach, where they've taken a look at some of their businesses. Another valuator may use a net asset approach, if it's a heavily, if it's like a real estate situation, or they might use, they might have used a income approach where they discounted, okay, use discounted values based on future earnings, future prospects, or the past earnings.
All right. So you may have two valuators or two somebody else other than you who's been called on from by one side or the other to present a valuation, and the judge may see two different numbers, right, at the end of the ledger.
And the judge will make a decision whether they believe which valuator he believes, or sometimes they'll just value the valuations, the average evaluation.
Do you look at the other evaluator's valuation in that type of situation before you testify, so you know what the differences are?
Absolutely.
Okay. And is it important for you to explain why there might be differences and why your method or why your number is more appropriate?
Absolutely. And if there's a problem, even in my evaluation, I'll bring that up in testimony.
Interesting.
And I'll say, okay, this is really what the number should be because I made this mistake here. I'll admit a mistake before. That normally doesn't happen, but if it's...
I like to say around my house that I'm the greatest apologizer ever because I make so many mistakes. I'm used to saying I'm sorry. I guess you don't say you're sorry when you're on the stand. You just say where you might have erred.
Well, I've been married a long time, and my secret to a long marriage is I go straight to surrender.
Okay, well, there's some logic to that, and I'm going to ask you about this in a marital situation in a moment. But I want to, before we move off the business arena, so to speak, in this topic, tell me about business valuations in the area where there's buy-sell agreement. When the parties formed their entity, they signed a buy-sell agreement. First, tell the folks what that is, and then why a valuation might be important when one group might want to sell.
A buy-sell agreement sets out the terms. If one, normally when one shareholder wants to leave, or when there's a death, or when there's a disability, it's important to set the value so that there's no disputes when the actual event happens. Normally, you like to update your valuations whenever there's a change in the business or at certain time intervals.
Let me ask you a question along the same line. So I call you and tell you that me and two or three people are forming a corporation, and we want to have a buy-sell agreement. We don't know what the thing is worth, but can you give me some direction? I'm asking you, as a potential client down the road or now, is there anything I should look to include in that buy-sell agreement that might eliminate or minimize potential conflict if one of us later decides that he or she wants to sell?
I would say set out the terms for the value for valuations. Now, when the company's going to be valued, who's going to evaluate it? Who's going to, in other words, are you going to have separate valuations based on the maybe one or two shareholders, two shareholder situation? Maybe you'll have each of them come up with a valuator. There's several other methods. One method is just have one valuator. Another method is to have two valuators and average evaluation. And the third method is to actually have two valuators and bring in a third valuator to make the decision which one is correct.
Wow.
And that's expensive, but those are basically the three types of advice I would give business owner.
You tell me, pick one, right? You don't leave it up in the air as to how you're going to do it. You pick a way of doing it now, right, that we may employ later?
Absolutely. Okay. Let's do this now because later you're going to have disputes. As a lawyer, in that kind of situation, you want to tell your clients to do whatever is going to keep them from having the most disputes.
All right. And I want to touch on ESOPs. First, tell folks what that is again and why evaluation might be important in that arena as well.
An ESOP is called Employee Stock Option Plan, and that's really a retirement plan. And how that works is, let's say I own a business and I want to set up this plan. I will actually go out to a bank and get a loan that might be whatever, $700,000 or whatever, then that could be millions of dollars. And my employees, based on normal attributes of a pension plan, the ones that qualify each year will get what's called a percentage of value of the business. Let's say it's 2% and the company's worth, and the valuation comes in $1 million, you're going to get 2% of that $1 million put into your plan in cash. The money comes from the bank loan, and the employer gets a tax deduction for all the money that goes into the plan. So you may have a situation where you're putting $200,000 into the plan, and the employee, based on the valuation, and the stockholder is getting a huge deduction on his business. I mean, on the business. Normally, you update these every year. You update the value every year.
Okay, and you as the value as the person that's doing the valuation would go in look at how you valued that plan the year before and see what changes might be appropriate.
Absolutely.
What might cause it to change in value?
The company may have losses. There may be other problems. The numbers change. I mean, you could have competitors come in and take away part of your business, or the company could double its income in the next year. It could be where they could. So there could be all kinds of factors like that.
Does the employer have any interest in that circumstance in the value of the plan being higher or lower?
Well, yeah. I mean, the higher the value, the higher the deduction is going to be.
So in that circumstance, when you say the deduction, that's the deduction to the employer, right? For his business.
To the company, yes.
Yeah. So is there ever any pressure on the person doing the valuation to push numbers up? And if so, how is that handled?
Well, if I get pressure from a client, I will tell them the only thing I'm going to do is give you my opinion. If I get pressure too hard from a client, I'll just withdraw from the engagement.
Okay.
You can't be, if you're going to be an expert, you have to only be an expert for your own opinion, not somebody else's.
That's a great line. I ought to write that down someplace.
Like you don't know that.
Well, I still think it's good to remember. Now, okay, so let's go to an area that I do know a little bit more about. Let's talk about divorce. And I want to specifically focus on a personal service type entity for a second. So me and my wife are getting divorced. I have a small, let's stick with lawyers since I know lawyers. I've got a small firm. There's three of us. We've been in business for 30 years, the entire time that my wife and I have been married. And now her lawyer is hollering at me that my business is marital property. My interest in my law firm is marital property, and she's entitled to a piece of it. Let's first start with you're brought in to work with the wife and her counsel. What do you do? What do you look for? And how do you even value something like that?
Well, the first thing I'll say to the lawyer is, what's the law in your jurisdiction? In some jurisdictions, that goodwill is personal. That can't be valued. You can't increase the value just based on that. In some jurisdictions, it may be an institutional goodwill.
Let's break that out for a second. When you talk about goodwill, what do you mean?
Goodwill is basically the ability to make more than a normal return on your assets, because the value is intrinsic to the person instead of the company.
So in my circumstance, if I'm the person whose business is being valued, right, wouldn't I want to say, well, listen, if I leave Bullitt, Jones and Blank, my people are going to come with me. I mean, that's the value is me. It's not what's here in the office. It's not the fact that we've been together for 30 years. It's the fact that people call me. Isn't that something that I would want to say in this dispute with my now soon to be former wife?
You want to say that. And if you're in a 2-person or 3-person law firm, you'll probably be successful. But if you're in a 100-person law firm, you might not be successful, because the judge may say, hey, people come to Joseph Greenwald Lake because of Joseph Greenwald Lake's reputation, not because of David Bullitt's reputation.
Well, I would argue with that personally, but that's for a different day. Okay, but so again, that people understand where the battle lines are drawn, right? So from my perspective, the value is with me, and goodwill in Maryland, for example, is non-marital. We know that it's not an asset that can be considered, whereas in some other jurisdictions it can. So I want the goodwill portion of this valuation to be as high as possible, right?
Exactly right.
My wife and her counsel want that goodwill factor to be pressed down. Like you said, I'm one of 40 lawyers at Joseph Greenwald Lake, and people come there. It's not me. They're going to keep coming whether I'm there or not.
That's right.
Okay. And so how do you look at goodwill, whether it's in, it doesn't have to be a law practice, we have medical practice or an accounting practice for that matter. How do you say to someone, well, the goodwill factor should be higher for you because, or lower for you because?
Let's take my firm, for example. Let's say we're doing $5 million a year. I have three partners, which I have. Well, actually, I have one partner. Let's say I have three partners, and I'm doing $4 million of the my clients comprise $4 million of that practice. Well, obviously, that's not in that situation. That's going to be personal goodwill. I would think the judge would look at it and say, okay, they're here because of you.
Right.
That type of situation. But if I'm, like I say, if I'm in a 15 person or 20 person accounting firm, that may not be the case.
And doesn't it also matter what kind of partner or shareholder you are? So if I'm a person, for example, and I bring in a lot of, I bring a ton of clients in, can they come, they call me, they come. My goodwill is likely to be pressed up higher as opposed to my partner down the hallway who really doesn't bring in that much business, but he generates the revenue. He does a lot of the legwork, the minding and the grinding, so to speak.
You know, I can find somebody to do minding and grinding. I can't necessarily find somebody who can be a salesman.
Right. So in that case, the salesman, as you call them, or the income rainmaker, income generator, the personal goodwill is going to be larger or lower than the minder and grinder.
You say the rainmaker? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. When you're talking about doing these valuations, what kind of pitfalls should people look for? What are their problem areas, things that you see that you can tell folks to look for and be mindful of?
Well, as a valuator, you got to use common sense. And one of the things that I do look at a valuation is, what would I pay for this business? Or what would somebody pay for this business? Now, can I give you an example where a valuator didn't do that?
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, I got referred to a widow whose husband had died a year or two earlier, and he had a couple of businesses where one of the largest valuation companies in the country had valued these businesses. The main business was a holding company that owned five different corporations. It owned a real estate corporation, which was about to be foreclosed on, but it has a lot of valuable real estate. It owned two defunct cell phone companies. It owned a golf course corporation, and it owned a nursery corporation. And I was asked to take a look at this, at least looks at these valuations. I said, what the company had done, had taken the real estate company, got taken the real estate appraisals, increased the value of that company minus all the liabilities, and came up with a value with no discounts. Well, why didn't they take a discount? And then the reason is because the courts normally don't like to see much of a discount. The IRS would like to see much of a discount when there's one shareholder. Well, guess what? I looked at this SIG and I said, they're about to lose the real estate. Who's going to be a customer for something like this? So I did a little research and I found a case called the Doherty case with almost the exact same facts, where the court had allowed a 25% discount for net asset value for lack of marketability and a 10% discount for odd mix of assets. So the client flew me down to Florida. I met with the widow. I met with the attorney that did the evaluation, that did the state tax return, and the attorney for Ford Motor Company, because that was somebody they were dealing with. And I turned to the attorney. I said, if you don't understand valuation theory, why don't you have this vetted by another valuator? He said, I don't want to spend $5,000. I said, what? You don't want to spend $5,000 to save $2.3 million? I said, look, I think you have an open and shut case here. The IRS is not going to want to lose another case like this, because it could cost them hundreds of millions of dollars. So fast forward, spent a lot of time, redid the valuations, redid the estate tax return, went to appeals passed on it. They sent it to the Senate Joint Committee that looks over large refunds like this. They passed on it. The client got back almost $2.7 million as a refund. Because that, they saved the real estate, they saved the company up in Detroit. Instead of being bankrupt, the widow and her children are now wealthy because they sold the real estate for $15 million. Valuation is called an art and a science. You got to use common sense when you look at these things.
Uh-huh.
Jeez. I think that's so important. And that's actually, I had another situation where I had the same thing happen and got a client back $1.6 million. So, you know, take a look at this from a business owner's point of view. Don't take a look at it. The problem I see, and you see this with attorneys, I see it with accountants, you're taught to follow a set of rules. So you're taught to think vertically. You're not taught to think horizontally. You gotta use your head.
I think that you're 100% right. And certainly in my world, particularly with folks who aren't experienced, and I think maybe that's true in your case, in your situation as well, people who aren't as experienced are more likely to just look inside their box of what they were taught in school or and whomever. Whereas once you've been around a little bit, you understand that that you need to spread out your thinking somewhat.
Yeah.
You know, for $5,000, they ought to cut you, at least bought you an ice cream cone or something on your way back to Maryland.
Well, to be honest with you, between all the work and all the talking, going through appeals and everything else, we made a lot of money that way. And then the widow was so happy, she gave us a nice bonus afterwards.
Nice. Well, we did
okay.
When you do a good job for folks, whatever field you're in, it's nice that they appreciate that. It doesn't happen all that much in the world of divorce, but it does sometimes. Now, one thing that strikes me, and then we're going to have to look to tie things up. You and I could talk or dig deeper on a lot of these issues for hours, I know. But are there any regulations, any rules that people need to follow when they're looking at these valuations? They just show up and run this formula or that formula. There's got to be some rules that you should refer to, right?
Well, the foundation for valuations with the service is Revenue Ruling 5960. And they talk about 8 factors, and I'm going to read these to you because the factors are 8 major factors: the nature of the business and the history of the enterprise since its inception, the economic outlook and the condition and outlook of the industry, the book value and financial condition of the business, the earning capacity of the business, unless we are only looking to the assets as the only source of value, dividend paying capacity of the business, prior sales of the stock and the size of the block to be valued, and the market value of stocks engaged in the same or similar lines of businesses. Now, as a certified valuation analyst, I have to follow a couple of sets of rules. I have to follow 5960. I have to follow the statements. I have to follow the National Association of Certified Valuators and Analysts standards. I have to follow as a CPA, I have to follow the statements on valuation services, SVSS 1. By the AICPA. If you have your credentialing from the American Society of Appraisers, you have to follow their sets of standards. There are many rules to follow.
Now, the Revenue Ruling 5960 that you mentioned, these are guideposts, right, as you go through what you need to do in terms of valuing a business. They don't give you specific formulas that you need to apply. They just give you factors that you need to consider. Right.
Correct. Exactly.
All right. So that is where, just to toggle back to what we spoke about several minutes ago, isn't that where and amongst those 8 factors we find the places where valuators come up with different opinions?
Of course.
All right. All right. So Ed, let me ask you this question. All right. I don't want to show your age or anything like that. But in the years that you've been practicing, tell our folks. How many valuations have you been part of or done, and how many different industries have you done these valuations in?
Okay, well, I've valued about 150 different businesses and 65 different industries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Give us a couple offbeat industries just for the fun of it.
Well, one industry was the client that supplies all the salmon to Whole Foods. That was an interesting.
That's
one.
Neat.
One is an automobile supply industry that supplies products to Ford Motor Company. There's been ophthalmology. There's all types of different businesses. I can read you a list.
And I don't want you to read me a list, but I do want to ask you one last question. And that is, if you can, summarize for me, what, if any, impact has the pandemic had on how folks who do what you do look at businesses as a whole?
Well, first of all, we look at the industry, what's been hit, things like restaurants and so forth. But we ask clients now, mostly that have been affected by the pandemic, give us some projections we can look at. Give us a 5-year projection, because we're going to use a discounted cash flow method, because we can't rely right now on past performance unless your company's doing well and hasn't been affected. But if you've been affected, I would say the only reliable method at this point, if it's not an asset heavy business such as real estate, is to use a discounted cash flow method. Let's look at the future, not look at the past, because the past may not be the
interesting. Past. It just gives you something else to have to think about and worry about in your business, doesn't it?
Yeah, because the past may not be indicative of the future now.
Yeah, yeah.
What they call about this new normal.
A new normal, yeah. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, but let me know when you find out what
you mean. All right, Ed, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great discussion here on JGL Law for You. If you could, let the folks out there know what the best way is to get hold of you if they're looking for someone to help them in any of these areas that we talked about, or get some direction when it comes to a business valuation.
The easiest thing is call me on my cell, 301-529-1618. You can call the office, 301-468-7700, extension 1101. You can email me. It's ebortnick@skmb.cpa. Or you can yell really loud. Maybe I'll hear you.
All right, Ed Bortnick, thank you very much again for joining us. And thanks to all of you out there for listening in. We hope you join us for our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.
Hey, thanks, David.